science has its own genesis story, similar to the biblical Genesis story, but it's more to do with around 1600 Newton pulling together whole sets of theories and ideas and calculus. Just this one person coming in and setting down a series of laws, pretty much like the Ten Commandments, but the sort of the three commandments of physics for which the world will continue to live by. Now, similar to the rest of the world being able to struggle and negotiate with the religious version, there's some, I suppose, teething difficulties working with the Newtonian version, the three laws. We still have to teach it as part of our cultural story because we've adopted it as a Genesis story for popular science. But the more you expand, the more you know, the more sort of twists and turns that you have to add to it. And if people are sitting down waiting for a good old yarn, the twists and turns, they're distractions. That person can't explain it as well. So this time I'm just going to just go through and spend it without too much complication, a gentle review of Newton's laws and how we teach them. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. Look, there's just so many aspects to this. As you read, the ancient ideas of inertia and action coming up to Newton, and you actually read his direct work, and it's actually written in Latin, so there's no terms for multiply. I think it's conjugate width is the best the Latin term for multiply is, but that gives you some idea. And then you go forward in time to Einstein and to special relativity, general relativity, and the Higgs boson. You've got all that sort of stuff, and if you look at it, we teach a fragment in that fragment history. This is Newton's view, and it's largely useful. It's historically significant, and we have to sort of respect that we've got a religious sort of way of teaching it, and the religious philosophy comes right through that it is you're teaching how nature, you know, the laws of nature, i.e. the laws of God. And when you really come down to it and read into Newton, he was believing that he was actually uncovering the laws of God. These are God laws. So the reason things of two masses were attracted to each other was because the mass was reported up to heaven. And God saw it, and so there was a God in the loop, implied in the loop. And if you read through it, I won't go too far into it, but there's that in there, and there's, at the end of the story, there's this customary, everyone believes it, a big scientist on the top of the hill believes it, you better believe it as well, that sort of customary force. And that's the way it is. So you've got these large spectrum of development of knowledge, you've got historical spectrums, you've got cultural spectrums, cultural groups all coming together, and we have sort of settled down on rather a stable view. And like most people in an island in a big ocean or dimensional space of possibilities, you can have a sort of village view, have your world reference to the local huts and the people around it, or you can actually look out over the horizon. All these big, different, deep ideas. Now, one of the things is that if you talk about these deep ideas, people who are familiar with the village chatter will find this really hard to understand. So I'm not going to do that. In this one, I'm just going to go through the ways we teach Newton's laws sort of middle school, late school, and sort of talk about probably the simplest version, the package version that you should have to take away with you. So what I'm going to do is just simply read from a children's website. Unfortunately, I did copy down which it is, and so I'm doing very bad. I should attribute it. But it's actually hard to find, or I'm sure I can find, they have a picture of Newton and a quote, which is a quote not from Newton, but from another person who's translated, and he's obviously... They're obviously not there. So there tends to be a quote for every force, there's an equal and opposite force. Things at rest tend to stay at rest. These are quotes. But if you read into Newton, it's really hard to actually find those terms. And look at the historical stuff. Newton was having a big battle with Descartes. And so Descartes actually had his three laws of motion. So he introduced others, and he didn't say he invented the laws of motion. He said these are things which are taken to be well known. So, but we won't go into that. We'll just go into the actual way that the genesis story of Newton. So Newton was English around 1600, a very multidimensional person to look at. Now, look, there are books written on him, and they're really interesting to wade through. And if you read the book, and someone has the little textbook summary of him, he was a boy, that some people may pick up his the diamond incident where his little dog burnt his papers. You sort of get used to to his character as he goes along the place. Newton's a big hero, and we try and teach that because Newton's our version of God, so. We just can't have the laws come down. They have to come down from someone. So we put up them. So here we go. The first law. The first law says that an object at rest tends to stay at rest, and an object in motion tends to stay in motion with the same direction and speed. Motion or lack of motion cannot change without an unbalanced force acting. If nothing is happening to you and nothing does happen, you will never go anywhere. If you are going in a specific direction, unless something happens to you, you will always go in that direction forever. And that's a beautiful children's version of it. And, of course, you have to teach them what rest, motion, speed and force are. So this is some of the basic things you do at primary school to do it. But this is an excellent explanation because it does it and then places the person in the frame of reference. But we won't say that. Now, it goes on. You can see good examples of today when you see video footage of astronauts. Now, I'm not going to read on that. Obviously, those astronauts are in free... video footage gives you the age of this anyway, but... the astronauts are in free fall. They're in a gravitational field. They're in a non-inertial frame of reference. And if they were to stick three ping pong balls on top of each other in their space station, as they orbited, the top ping pong ball would experience a force and lag behind. Oh, God. And the bottom ping pong... Sorry, I was just nearly attacked by this bowerbird. Just flew at me very quick and turned around. Sorry. The bottom ping pong ball, which is at a slightly lower orbit... would travel a bit faster, or if you although the video footage tends to do it, there's a lot more going into it. There's a system which can be explained by forces, that is actually going in a big circle, which goes all the way back to Aristotle. But we won't go into that. So that's first law. It says, for example, if a planet's gravity pulled on it, oh dear, I won't go into that one. Second law. The second law says, I like that, that acceleration of an object produced by a net total applied force is directly related to the magnitude of the force, the same direction as the force, and inversely related to the mass of the object. Inverse is the value that is 1 over the other number. The inverse of 2 is a half. The second law shows that if you exert the same force on two objects of different mass, you get different accelerations, changes in motion, really changes in speed, but and motion, that's correct direction. The effect acceleration on the smaller mass will be greater and more noticeable. The effect of a 10 newton force on a baseball will be much greater than the same force acting on a truck. The difference in effect acceleration is entirely due to the difference in their masses. So that's a relatively really good thing. An object will... Oh, I'll have to stop now. Hello, back again. One of the things is that you have to teach acceleration to the people, mass to the students, the basics here. They've tried to discuss about a net total, so this is balanced and unbalanced forces and directions, so there's a lot of background development for it. I suppose my overall comment is that the first and second law apply to something we call an object, which is, I suppose, a conceptual construct, as we have in object-oriented. The term in Newton's world is bodies, and we tend to draw a body as a circle or a square with a dot in it, but we'll get into that at some point. So there's a lot to teach there. We'll go into the third law, you'll recognize some of this from your earlier, the way this is earlier taught, which tends to be quotes which are attributed to Newton. I won't go into what Newton said. He was very much dealing with existence ideas of the time, which have now people laugh at because they now know Newton. So his things travelling in a straight line and changing direction was an Aristotelian idea, that the perfect motion was a circular motion. In fact, Galileo believed that when he rolled his ball down a ramp, it would eventually travel forever in a very gentle circle, which is correct. So if he had a rail which went around the Earth, the ball would travel naturally around it because he didn't have gravity. So there's a whole series of things that Newton knew to clarify things. But again, the first and second law applies to loosely called objects. In physics, we call them bodies. Now, the third law, quoting from this one, the third law says that for every action, bracket force, there is an equal and opposite reaction force. Forces are found in pairs. Think about the time you sit in a chair. Your body exerts a force downwards, and the chair needs to exert an equal force upward, or the chair will collapse. It's an issue of symmetry. Acting forces encounter other forces in the opposite direction. There's also an example of shooting a cannonball. When the cannonball is fired through the air by the explosion, brackets, the cannon is pushed backwards. The force pushing the ball out is equal to the force pushing the cannon back. But the effect on the cannonball is less noticeable because it's a much larger mass. That example is similar to a kick when a gun fires a bullet forward. Look, there's lots of issues here. Now, the word action is different from what we mean action nowadays. A problem. So, action is the overall thing that you do to an object to make it move. So this is the ancient pre-word for force. So this is a complexity. The third word here deals with not just one body but two bodies. It's a system, and the way that Newton explained it was to do with inertia, as he describes there. So reaction is an action in the opposite direction. The modern definition of action is the integral of Lagrangian, which is related to energy of an object over time, and over time it's got a unit of joule seconds. I did a podcast on that. So there is a bit of a linear problem that people who understand the ancient and modern know that Newton was using the word there, and again, he wrote it in Latin. But that for every action, there's an equal and opposite action, reaction. It basically sort of links into our modern day culture. I could go through and read it to you again, but we have the idea of recoil, the law of recoil. So that's a view of how it's taught in a simple children's text. And you can see there's a lot of complexities, there's a level of complexity about what you have to teach the students prior to the introduction of it, because if you suddenly teach this lesson number one, they won't know what mass is, they won't know what acceleration is. You can sort of demonstrate it by a few examples, essentially people can tick off it's rote learned if they can actually rote learn the actual verbal stuff. So something at rest will stay at rest, and something in motion will stay in motion in the same direction unless a force acts on it. Now, they've introduced the word unbalanced force. An unbalanced force acts on it. An object, in brackets, a body, an object will accelerate in a direction proportional to the force in that direction. They can say net force, and inversely proportional to the mass. That's the thing that you want to rote learn. And for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. People rote learn that, and if they write that down in a test, they get full marks. Their understanding, and it's a complex thing. Now things progress to high school, and you have to unplug this. And this is a high school retelling of Newton's law. So you have to morph from pre-Newton to the Newton's law demonstration and have accessible demonstrations to it. And then at high school, you have this sort of parallel, it's sort of like a self-defined thing, that an inertial frame of reference is a frame of reference in which Newton's laws apply. That's a basic, and there's no acceleration of the frame of reference, or you have to introduce, if the frame of reference is accelerating, you have to introduce fictional forces, or I don't know. Let's just read this here. This is from Wikipedia, which I thought is the shortest, neatest way of explaining it. The first law: in an inertial frame of reference, an object either remains at rest or continues to move at a constant velocity unless acted upon by a force. Now, here you have to explain what velocity is. That's her speed and direction. Unless acted upon by a force acts on an object. It acts due to action. It's ancient idea of what an action is. The second law: in an inertial frame of reference, the vector sum of forces on an object is equal to the mass of the object multiplied by the acceleration of the object. F equals ma. It is assumed that the mass is constant. Okay, so again, of an object. Again, they're going somewhere with that. Now, in both those, they've said the inertial frame of reference. And that's sort of a self-defined thing, that inertial frames of references, first and second law, apply. Okay. The third law: when one body exerts a force on a second body, the second body simultaneously exerts a force equal in magnitude and opposite in direction on the first body. Now, here they're using the word body, and at the top of the frame they're using the word object. So body is the, I'm glad I pointed that out. This Newton didn't really formulate it in terms of force. He formulated it in terms of inertia, if you actually go back read it. But the third law applies to systems, that is, two bodies interact, and essentially things can be accelerating and go under a force. What happens is that's sort of macroscopic when they actually touch and go through a three-part, in terms of motion, a three-part process of them coming together, losing kinetic energy, storing as potential energy, so their relative motion goes to zero, and then springs apart. Depends upon it. That's how you deal with collisions. We'll have to go into a little bit more. So this is doesn't require inertial frame of reference. So the inertial frame of reference is law one and law two. This one is to do with a system, two bodies touching, an exchange of momentum. The momentum exchange is the same, but to have the momentum exchange the same, a consequence of that is that the forces are equal and opposite. So that concludes as sort of an authentic stripping off of the internet. You do have textbooks, and the textbooks take a little bit more care to couch this as customary knowledge, and puts things in quotes with pictures of Newton's, a little bit of a story of Newton. But essentially the idea is that there are three laws, and that in lower school you want them to quote it, in higher school you want them to start to begin to write equations and know when they read a question to use the first law to say why a passenger, unrestrained passenger, will go through the front of the windscreen if under a second brake. The second law is to do with, why a rocket going up into the atmosphere will begin to accelerate, because it's constant force, its mass is reducing for an object. Again, it's the way that you define an object there. Third law is for a collision crumple zone and things like that. There's a force and starting to look at the forces through them. I suppose the important thing is that Newton had several constraints or several things. He had some ancient ideas floating about, the Aristotelian ideas, the ideas of inertia and action. So action was what you apply to a body to get it to move. So that's why that's what it's called. These terms have moved a little bit, and of course Newton's highly revised. So sort of Newton's law is something which exists in Euclidean space, and in Einstein's space-time it changes about. We're talking about what you practically teach students, and the important thing is how you write this shorthand basically on a card for students to remember basically what it is and what you accept. So unfortunately, if you write things in shorthand and it's stated and it's sort of not universally accepted, it's hard to, you have to then train the students to unpack that for the examiner. So look at shorthand. Rather than writing first law, second law, third law, it's N1 colon, N2 colon, N3 colon as a shorthand writing. So now bear in mind that Newton didn't like Descartes and was writing in Latin. I must admit to reading his original scripts, I really can't remember ever reading what we would recognise as an equation. Things were written out in longhand. This is the revolution of Descartes using pronumerals. Descartes Descartes had a whole lot of innovations. And so those innovations sort of slipped into the text, and then people have substituted insight by actually stating the law in the pre-Descartes stuff and then translating it into Descartes equations and saying, well, that's teaching, I've taught it now. I go, if f equals zero, if the sum of f equals zero, then a equals zero. And then you could probably say in an inertial frame of reference, but you really don't need it there. So f is drawn as a vector. So this is what you understand everything that describes it. So if something at rest remaining at rest, or something at velocity remaining at the same velocity, is the a equals zero, and no unbalanced force acting at the sum of forces equals zero, and inertial frame of reference. So that's N1. The sum of forces, if the sum of forces equals zero, A equals zero, brackets, for inertial frame of references. For N2, the sum of forces equals MA, vector A, for inertial frame of forces. And for N3, F subscript 1, 2 equals minus F subscript 2, 1. So you have to teach the students what F 1, 2 means. It means the force of 1 acting on 2 equals minus the force of 2 acting on 1. So you have to tell them how to do vectors and diagrams like that. And this is the entire thing that modern, this is the advantage of Cartesian or equations. Equations, I think it used to take 2 or 3 pages to write a quadratic, and if you read Renaissance mathematicians, or even poems about maths, they're really complicated, and you have to really think. And they're really good for you. You have to really think of it. But we do have the shorthand of equations, so we're sort of caught in a time, sort of in two aspects. There's a time warp, and we have to organise a progression for kids to go through from seeing Newton's first law of motion. Second, the you know, moral codes of decoding moral issues with the Ten Commandments. It's been able to quote access the correct N1, N2, N3 for the appropriate situation, and at what point in the early stage where you teach students about mass, velocities, bodies and objects, you've got to have it fragmented enough such that they can see little fragments and then apply it. So how do you transition to that, and where the end goal is? And for a lot of people, the end goal, it's not the equations, but this other thing where we actually specify things out written in text. And again, while we are satisfied written in text, is a sort of a cultural thing where we're at the moment with the actual current cohort. So you've got to be aware of that. So indeed, you can actually basically teach. So what I would recommend is at the start of a lesson writing N1, N2, N3 down there, and then have a bit of both, the best of both worlds. So for a problem associated with, say, N1, you write N1, the mathematical version of it, and then the long text version of it, and then the problem solved. with reference to the above. So it's a complex world here, and I'm just doing this podcast in reference to the understanding that of taking plenty of time to go slowly, and that people do like hearing about things they've already learnt, and they really only want to hear. They really only want, say, rather than 10% of what they know and 90% of new stuff, they really want to go through and have 90% of what they know, depending on what mode you're in, and 10% or just a suggestion of new stuff. So I'm adopting that in this podcast. This is Peter Hill Explains.